From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
The message has become increasingly clear. By shifting the palette of what we plant toward native and refining the practices we employ in caring for our landscapes, we gardeners can make a contribution to the greater ecology. We can create pieces of functioning habitat that support biodiversity. We've heard about saying no to vast stretches of mown lawn and about removing invasives and about leaving the leaves in fall, among many important changes we're urged to make, but we probably don't know all the nuts and bolts involved in best accomplishing each such updated practice. Now a new book can help. Today's guest has written Nature's Action Guide, a sort of workbook detailing all the how-tos of ecological horticulture needed to get us there, not just which key environmentally focused actions to take, but step-by-step checklists to accomplish each one. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for Away to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
My guest today is Sarah F. Jane, whose new book, Nature's Action Guide, begins with a foreword by Doug Tallamy. Doug's own book, Nature's Best Hope, inspired Sarah to write hers as a sort of companion volume. Sarah, who lives in gardens in Pennsylvania, has done a lot of the homework for us in this book, distilling all the key points to consider for each project and providing vetted lists of expert resources we can turn to for more information. I'm so glad to welcome her today and especially eager to ask her about a couple of the topics that I'm bogged down on right now in my own garden, including removing invasives. So hi, Sarah, I hope you're ready for that one. How are you?
Very well, and it's such a delight to talk to you today.
Oh, good. So you're in Pennsylvania and is your garden kind of wildish, or how would you describe it?
Describe it as quite wild. I've had to tame the front of the garden because I do live in a neighborhood. And I kind of use it as a test plot to figure out what are the best strategies for surviving in a neighborhood that has different standards than I do. But my back is quite wild and quite alive. And in fact, the front is alive as well.
Yes. So the book is very interesting. First, I should say that with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com, we'll have a book giveaway. People can enter to win a copy of the book, and I've been enjoying it. And it's kind of structured. It's like there's like 15 sort of action item steps they're not exactly chapters, but sort of like the chapters, the sections. And, you know, some from like turn off the lights at night, you know, get rid of artificial light at night, or have water in the garden year round, and all kinds of other things. And then ones about planting and design. And so it's a quite a diverse list of possibilities of actions we can take. Tell us a little bit more. I sort of hinted at it that you were inspired, as many of us are, by Doug Tallamy's work. Tell us a little bit about how it came to be.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. You see, I was one day after many, many, many hours of trying to remove invasives and plant native plants, it was very challenging, despite having had over three decades of experience in both farming and gardening. And I sat on my sofa and just thought, oh my goodness, it's impossible. And and then I decided we should move near the Tallamy's. And so that really energized me. And I went outside. And I was weeding about a week later, and I came across a scrap of paper, and it had a little return address label on it. And I looked at it and did a double take. It was the Tallamy family. And I'm like, whoa, is this the Tallamy family, the Doug Tallamy family? And it turns out that the Tallamys live two properties over from my house.
Isn't that crazy? So this was a piece of like trash, like litter on the ground?
Yeah,
that's crazy.
It made it underneath my persimmon tree and weeding out the ground ivy. And this was long before I had the idea for the book, and I couldn't contact the Tellamys because I had come from a fruit growing background and I had planted a lot of invasive fruits before I knew better. Mm. And because invasive, I mean, our edible fruit plants are, many of them are quite invasive. So I worked away at getting, you know, these eliminated before I could possibly show my face. But then I got the idea for the book, and I just thought, goodness, if this is so impossible for me, it must be really hard for the typical homeowner who doesn't have any gardening experience.
Right.
And yeah, this just, you know, kind of overwhelmed me. I sent Doug, I created an outline for the book, and I sent Doug a letter, and I said, you know, I think your books are wonderful, because they are, but that they need a companion guide. So he said, great, write it.
Good.
So 4 years later.
Yeah, here we are. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the one section is, as I said in the introduction, I think that particularly caught my attention because I'm focused on it right now. My own garden, which is in upstate New York or the Hudson Valley of New York State, is how to tackle invasives. And it's a good example of kind of how you approach this. This is something that's easy to get overwhelmed. And not all invasive plants have the same sort of life cycle, life history, structure. How you get rid of one isn't how you get rid of another, and so on and so forth. And it's easy to just get paralyzed. It's easy to just say, oh, it's bigger than I am, I can't deal with it, kind of thing. And in the book you mentioned, there's more than 1,200 invasive species in the United States, and more than 700 of those are still for sale. So one thing we can do is not buy them anymore. Like English ivy or whatever. But you have sort of a checklist of how to go about conceiving of your attack plan against invasives. And it's very logical. And it kind of made me exhale and feel, yes, that's right. That's the way to do it and not get overwhelmed. So can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah.
What are some of the steps? Yeah.
Well, each action chapter starts with a checklist like that. Because I want it to be really clear, because it is very confusing, all these different puzzle pieces to creating a functioning wildlife habitat. So the checklist for removing invasive plants starts with the one that you mentioned, which is really get to know your plants so that you know which ones not to purchase and which ones not to share. Even among gardeners, you know, we've often shared plants, and often those are invasive plants because those are the ones that are growing so aggressively and we have extras to share.
Right. A lot of our ground covers traditionally in ornamental horticulture have turned out to be quite invasive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So we want to know which ones to avoid. And also we want to train ourselves to identify the seedlings at the invasive plants at their seedling stage. Because if you can do that, you can save yourself hours and hours and years of removing invasives. And it's so much easier to remove them at that seedling stage. So the learning how to identify them, there's wonderful online resources such as the invasive.org and also a government site, which is invasives species. Well, that's invasivespeciesinfo.gov. Mm-hmm. So these have That particular site is very handy because it shows the most difficult ones that we're all facing. So when you get to know those, you're getting to know the biggest problematic, the biggest troublemakers, should
right.
I say.
Right.
And
so, No, you say, so you advise us. So we need to avail ourselves of those types of resources to become visually familiar with what these plants look like at all their different life stages so that we know who's hiding, who's lurking, so to speak, and especially at the fringes of your garden. A lot of times, you know, there can be a lot of visual distraction. It's not so clear what's what. And I think you say in the book, one thing is to sort of make a list, like note what's on your property and where it is. Like do that first, like do a little bit of a survey, right? Take stock of what you've got. Yeah. And then what to start with? What should we start with? I mean, because it's not the biggest, patch of the thing, right? It's, I think you very helpfully say sometimes that's not the place to go first, to the largest expanse.
Yeah. Yeah, intuitively, I mean, counterintuitively, I say, one does go to that because that looks like what you need to tackle. But the real trick is tackling the single stilt grass plant that's in your otherwise clean bed, because that's that single stilt grass plant can put out 1,000 seeds. And then the next season and for 4 or 5 years after that, you'll be dealing with that. But if you happen to be right on top of it and you get that out this year in that otherwise clean bed, you've spared yourself lots and lots of future.
Right. So we look for these small isolated patches that really, if we leave them till next year, are going to be medium or big patches. We go and get those. We look around for those. And that takes a little more looking. It's not quite so obvious as a big burning bush that's in its full fall color, you know, in October, that's already established itself and is 4 feet tall. You know, it's not quite so obvious.
Yeah. And then you can also take that inventory that you've created when you first sort of monitor your property and note what the seeding time is, because that's the other trick. It's getting them before they go to seed and learning which ones, because there's no sense in removing stilt grass now, for example, or even in October. It's already set at seed. But if you can get all of these plants before they set seed, then you're really also sparing yourself a lot. And identifying from the invasive species info.gov, those biggest troublemakers, tackle them first because they're on that list for a reason.
Right. So we want to remove, we want to identify if we have some of the most problematic species like Oriental bittersweet, for instance, or burning bush, I think, you know, for me in the Northeast, I mean, that's one that really spreads around a lot. A lot of these are things that spread by fruit. You alluded to fruit being a fruit grower, but even non-human edible fruit, the fruit is the thing that moves plants around pretty easily a lot because of the birds and so forth. But I have to say, I would rather, and I was glad it sort of, your book kind of affirmed it. My approach is more, I'd rather spend the time on those than on the hours and hours on, you know, going after dandelions or creeping Charlie, Glaucoma heteracea in the lawn, which, you know what I mean? It doesn't worry me in the same way that these prolific, these woody fruit bearing prolific spreaders that have just taken over our woodlands and so forth do. So, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it also feeds into the idea that one of the other things we need to attempt to do is to change people's aesthetics. Because as we could do that, we can allow some of the less difficult non-native invasive plants, but maybe less problematic, allow them while we tackle the ones that are damaging our woodlands.
Yeah, because there are only a certain number of hours in the day. I mean, you know, it is, so you're saying a triage approach is both in, which I think is really smart. And then what about disposal? You know, because we're going to have a lot of stuff that we've either dug out or cut down or both, or what about disposal?
Yeah, I think that poses a really good question. The way I handle it might not be how everyone chooses to handle it, but I don't prefer to take it to the landfill. Some landfills don't even permit invasive plant debris to be delivered there, and I don't want to burn it. So what I do is I've dedicated a small area hidden from neighborhood view, and I put a stack of the plants as I gather them there, and I monitor it. And if it's something really that has the potential for birds to feed on it, I cover it with a tarp until it's covered with other plants. And I let that area be a place that collects all the really troublemakers, because a lot of times it may have a reproductive part, roots or a berry that I missed getting early. So that pile sits there and I monitor it. So it doesn't go in my compost, but it does go essentially in a compost pile. We call it maybe the toxic waste compost pile. So, that's how I handle it. You can put a tarp under that, but I haven't found that to be necessary. Maybe start with layers of cardboard underneath it just to, in case you have a root in your first layer, being careful about what the first layer is and then monitoring it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you've segregated this stuff and you're keeping an eye on it. You're not putting it in the main compost heap. Yep. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And Yeah, I mean, I probably do. It's for me, it depends on what it is, but some of the things that are leafier, sometimes there's so much bulk, and if it's rhizomatous, herbaceous stuff that's rhizomatous, I may just cut off the rhizomes, the root sort of area, and compost the leaves, but do what you're saying in the segregated pile, put the naughty bits, the roots,
Yeah, in fact,
yeah.
the non bad parts of the plant, they can go. I sometimes put them on the woodland pathways or on just an area, it's kind of hidden from my neighbor's view, but just to build up the soil for woodland plants, for
Right, so
example.
sort of composting in place, like letting them the debris just degrade, as long as it's not any part that can reproduce by either, again, like root material, rhizomes, whatever, or seeds, fruit and seeds and so forth.
Yeah, definitely.
Another, there were a number of sort of tactics in the book, and just that it's if you're just a homeowner, not even a gardener, that I think are so important, and I'm still surprised that more people don't do them. I mentioned one in the introduction about artificial light at night, for instance. This it's so harmful to insect populations, and yet we all have so many floodlights going on at night, home after home, and especially in public spaces. What I loved is that you give a lot more detail about how to think about it and some of the tactics for dealing with it, I think. And that's true with all of the sort of sections, the checklists and sections in the book. Or like water, you talk about ways that we can not only provide water all year long, but also about preventing animals from being harmed by bodies of water, like swimming pools are a real death trap for a lot of like amphibians and so forth. Yes.
Yes. Well, it's so interesting because, like you and I, who are gardeners and have been gardeners for all our lives, basically, almost all our lives, it sounds like, we do all these things for wildlife. And then we have these things that we're not aware of, like a million birds striking our windows every day in the
Yes.
US. And our cats
A
are.
billion, at least. In fact, they've upgraded it. They even think it may
Yes.
be as high as 5 billion. And I mean, the estimates are so staggering. It's
Yes.
unbelievable.
It really is. And that's in the US. The statistics globally are even more extreme. Cat predation is three times greater than that figure, the glass strikes and the light at night. So these are things, and we love our cats, but here we are, we're doing all this stuff for nature, and then we don't realize it, and we have our beloved cat out there kind of taking us up the well, and then we're sliding back down 3 feet further, sort of like the snail going up the well. And these are things that we really can, as you suggested, take easy action, turning out the lights, screening and marking our windows, keeping our cats indoors, or building them a nice outside cat catio.
I love
And
the catio. That's hilarious. Yes.
yeah, and these are things we can all do, non-gardeners and gardeners alike, and we can do them today. So that was very important to me, to try to get those messages out there and to make it easy for people to do them, to take those actions.
And to prevent again, like frogs or salamanders or whatever, from getting into a pool of water that has no escape, where it's too there's no way to climb out. Like having some mechanism. I mean, I have some water trough type water features as well as in-ground water features. And one thing each of them has, whether it's the permanent in-ground ones or the temporary seasonal ones, each one has like a little gangplank, where they can get in and out. So even if the water gets, it's we have a dry spell and I forget to top everything up and you can't climb out easily, there's this little gangplank in or out. Do you know what I mean? So nobody
I
gets
do know that
stuck.
an exit ramp, that's what every water source needs, even our buckets. It's wonderful that you have those. And we don't, I really, part of the whole motivation on the protection action is to prevent people from having to experience discovering a dead bird in a bucket of water that they left, as I've done, and feeling, for the rest of your life, you hold this, small tragedy that you incurred. And So each of the actions that are about protection are really come from experience of having, you know, not realized how my action might have hurt a creature.
Right. And then on the sort of the other side, the more maybe cheerful side, there's the planting and being more strategic in our planting. And you have, for instance, one section about something that Doug Tallamy talks about a lot, about how to identify and utilize keystone plants, the sort of most bang for the buck kind of plants, both woody and herbaceous. So tell us a little bit about maybe that, about that approach to picking which plants we want to make room for in our landscapes.
Well, it's really fabulous because I know when I started writing the book, keystone was a word that was even hard to find anywhere on the internet, really good information about it. And now there are fabulous resources, courtesy of Doug's tireless efforts, that working with others to create the National Wildlife Foundation, Federation's Native Plant Finder, for example. And there you can hop onto that Native Plant Finder, enter your zip code, and find the species that are the keystone species in your ecoregion. Mm-hmm. And this is a resource that just didn't exist, which makes it possible for us to choose the plants that will most support our local fauna. And that resource, and then along with others, learning, for example, once you know which plants they're recommending, then using something like the BONAP maps, which are maps that show the distribution of plants, and use them to identify which species actually are native in your specific area. And you have to use some judgment, and you have to put together things. That's what I actually explain in the book. But it's just such a tool that makes it doable in a way that it,
I was going to say, so BONAP is the Biota of North America project, and it's a series of maps that shows the nativity or lack of the same of different species of different genera of plants and so forth. And so you can kind of go through all the oaks and see which ones are native where and which states. It's maps. It's U.S. maps, and they're color-coded according to where things are native. And it's not super precise down to like the town level or anything, but it gives you a sense. So that's an important. I was interested in the book you talk about how much more, you know, so keystone plants, you could have a list and you kind of recommend to us that we become aware of what our keystone plants are, both woody and herbaceous, our top contenders, woody plants and herbaceous plants. But you point out that woody plants, in terms of attracting those all important Lepidoptera, the butterflies and moths that, you know, give us those caterpillars that the birds rely on and so forth, feed the fuel, the food chain. The woody plants outperform so much compared to even the top herbaceous plants, don't they?
Yes, it's when you actually look at those numbers, it's really amazing, because we're in our culture, it's great. It's coming to the forefront that we need to be planting these plants for our pollinators and our Lepidoptera, our moths and butterflies, and the caterpillars to be specific. So we sort of were out there and we're planting goldenrod and asters, and that's wonderful because they do support, for instance, in the Atlantic region, 115 different Lepidoptera species. So that's wonderful. But of the top, you know, the oaks are 534, but even down, say 20 down, the chestnuts, for example, or even a beech tree, these provide 125 to 100, you know, different species. So that the highest of our perennials is still lower than the, you know, some of the top woody plants.
Right. So the woody plants, they are the powerhouse of all powerhouses in many cases. So it gives us, makes us want to think about, when I was reading that section of the book, you know, really think about making room for more sort of shrubberies, mixed borders, you know, not just that herbaceous layer, herbaceous layer, herbaceous layer, but really think about not only the beauty of having the intermediate and the taller layers visually, but the power behind it. So in the last couple of minutes, I just wanted to ask you, in your own garden, kind of, are you at one of these junctures yourself? Are you currently taking some of these actions or focused on some of these actions most of all, or any projects planned for spring or Like I said, I'm doing very targeted invasive stuff now, is what I'm up to. I wondered if you have any such focal points.
Yeah. Well, my goal is, it's slow because, of course, I'm doing it on a DIY and on a budget. I'm working on getting the front lawn to be ecologically valuable while also fitting into a traditional neighborhood, and then using that as more fodder for how to translate that message to others, to help so that we can all, we're all in this together. So however we can figure out how to make it easier for everyone is really my goal. And so that's what my main focus is on right now. Mm-hmm. And I use the book all the time to help me along with it too.
That's great. So it's your work. It's your workbook, and you wrote it as well. That's great. Well, Sarah Jane, it was really nice to speak to you. And we'll have a book giveaway, as I said, with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. But yeah, I love that you sort of took all these things that I have, you know, saved in my browser or on little notes here and there or whatever, all these resources, so many great resources here to explore, to learn how to do the different steps and where to go for more information about local plant lists and, you know, the keystone plants, all these things. Really, really helpful that you've gathered all this into one handbook/workbook. So thank you. Thanks very much.
You're so welcome. I'm just thrilled that, you know, if we can each take these actions, we can really make a difference. So
well,
it's wonderful.
Yes, it is. So thank you. And I hope I'll talk to you again soon.
Likewise. It was a sheer delight.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.